Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. SUNY Chancellor John King delivered his annual address this week. King spoke on a range of topics, including a new adult learner program, but the chancellor made sure to address federal threats to higher education as well. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network reports.
King used the State of the University address to say he's committed to defending research projects and DEI initiatives in the face of possible federal funding cuts.
Ultimately, DEI is the secret sauce that gives universities the unique power to bring Americans together across all lines of difference, geography and race, religion and income, politics and nationality.
President Donald Trump, however, says universities are spreading, quote, radical left ideology through certain courses and DEI initiatives. While King never mentioned Trump by name in his speech, he later told reporters that he's concerned by the administration's orders to cut funding at other institutions.
Why would you undermine what is one of the most important assets for making America stronger, healthier, and more economically successful?
King says SUNY's universities and colleges get $700 million in federal funding for its research. Some SUNY schools have already lost some of those grants but are backfilling the funding through state and university programs. In Albany, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul is no fan of her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo. But as WNYC's John Campbell reports, a reported federal investigation into Cuomo has Hochul coming to his defense.
When asked if the Trump administration's investigations into Cuomo and other New York Democrats are politically motivated, Governor Hochul didn't hesitate.
Hell yeah.
She went on to call out the U.S. Attorney General by name.
The question is, when will Pam Bondi stop politicizing the Department of Justice and just do their jobs?
The Associated Press reports the DOJ opened an investigation about a month ago into whether Cuomo lied to Congress about his handling of nursing homes during the pandemic. The Justice Department is also investigating State Attorney General Letitia James in connection with a home she purchased in Virginia. She's denied wrongdoing. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
Personal assistants in New York's home care program will now have a bit more time to get enrolled with a new single statewide provider due to an extension in a federal case. But this could be just the first extension we see. The New York Public News Network's Emily Watkins has more.
Back in April, the initial preliminary federal court injunction regarding the state's Consumer-Directed Personal Assistance Program, or CDPAP, set into gear new guardrails for the transition to a single company running the program. This included a new deadline for workers to switch companies by June 6. However, on Tuesday, the judge in the case decided to extend that deadline to June 20. Attorney Elizabeth Joas represents CDPAP users in this case.
There are other people whose personal assistants continue to come to the house and provide them with care, but who haven't been paid, leaving them in a pretty precarious and tricky position as well. And we just think that we should all be taking every step possible to get those people set up and enrolled so that their PAs can be paid all the way back to April 1st.
When BTPM NPR spoke with Joas earlier this week, her team was expecting the judge to allow them to submit a proposal for an extension on Tuesday. Instead, the judge provided a short extension to allow Joas' team and the state to negotiate a longer extension or additional guardrails. In a statement to BTPM NPR immediately after the ruling, Joas said, quote, "We need the state to use all of its resources to fix these issues," end quote. Attorneys will have to submit their agreed-upon briefing schedule with the court by next Tuesday. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Emily Watkins in Buffalo.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. On this week's Legislative Gazette, we're sitting down with Natasha Pernicka, the executive director of both the Alliance for a Hunger-Free New York, formed the New York State Community Food Assistance Network, and the food pantries for the Capital District. You can find out more at https://hungeractionnys.org. Welcome, Natasha Pernicka.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, you have been intimately involved with hunger in the Capital Region and following the trends when it comes to food insecurity. You've also been involved in the food pantries and helping feed people, get them quality food, and help them, you know, not only feed their children but themselves. And now we're seeing coming out of Washington major cuts proposed to SNAP benefits, to Medicaid, and to other things that affect our ability to provide people with food. And we've already had food insecurity on the rise. Am I describing this all accurately, Natasha?
Yeah, it's really difficult to understand right now the cuts to the SNAP program at a federal level. We know that SNAP is a really effective program in helping people keep food on the table. People are able to go to the grocery store, pick food items that they're used to eating. You know, it's a lot better than people having to turn to a food pantry where we have, you know, limited supply chain for food pantry. We do the best we can through the charitable food system. And, you know, that's our mission, is to help people have food. But the impact of SNAP is billions and billions of dollars. That's not something that charity can make up for.
And these, you know, this is me now speaking, my opinion, are basically crumbs that we're giving to people who have little or nothing so that they can get by on some bare subsistence level. And, you know, this is, in the grand scheme of a budget, a very small amount of money.
Yes, it's true. It's true. And it's very disappointing because you're talking about, you know, crumbs, but it is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. So it's not meant to cover the entire month's food supply. It's meant to be supplemental. But yet the reality for a lot of people is that this is a major source of resource for food. I recently took the SNAP challenge just as a demonstration to kind of show how far does the average SNAP benefit go. It's $6 a day. On average, some people in New York have as little as $26 a month in SNAP benefit. Larger families might get more. But, you know, trying to eat or feed yourself or a family off of $6 per person per day is very challenging in order to get your food needs met. And this is where a lot of people turn to food pantries then to help supplement the supplemental SNAP program. One of the challenges with the bill that was just passed in House is that they're looking to push billions of dollars of SNAP resources onto states. And that it doesn't make any sense. It's billions of dollars, and states don't have the resources to make up for that loss, which means you're going to end up with even more people having to turn to the charitable food sector, which is, I mean, we have incredible communities. It's ingrained in our culture to feed the hungry, right? But the hungry, who we call the hungry, is growing. It really is about food insecurity, and we're seeing a lot more working people, families that have two incomes that are not making the threshold for making all their household bills. United Way just released their newest ALICE report, which stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. It's basically people who are working low-wage jobs. And here in across New York, in particular in the Capital Region, you know, it's over 40% of households are really struggling between do I pay rent? Do I get my car fixed? Do I put gas in the car? Do I get the plumbing fixed? Can I buy groceries?
That's an astonishing percentage, Natasha. Say that again.
It's more than 40% of households are not making enough money to make ends meet. So that includes households that are in poverty, but it also includes working households, people with low-wage jobs. You can take a look, United Way Alice report, it's over 40% of the households in our community.
Yeah, and it seems like we're moving away from this idea that food is a basic right for human beings. I know it's not on the law in New York, right? And it certainly doesn't seem to be seen that way from Washington.
Yeah, the United States is one of the few, shall I say, civilized nations that doesn't recognize food as a basic right. And that's unfortunate because that means our policies and programs from federal and state don't ensure for every person to have enough food to eat. It's something that we have determined is not a right. And there is a movement towards recognizing food as a human right. In fact, Maine was the first state in the U.S. to recognize food as a human right. And we do have a bill here in New York State working towards recognizing food as a human right. I think it's counterproductive to put food on the chopping block because we talk a lot about wanting our children to do well in school. We did have a win for universal free school meals in New York this year in the budget. That was a win. However, you know, what are the kids going to eat when they go home for dinner and on the weekends?
Right.
Right. And we also need our workforce to be productive and have energy. And I don't know about you, but if I don't eat well, I don't perform as well.
Well, this is the Yeah, this is the ripple effect, Natasha, right? I mean, if you're not eating properly, it's going to have all sorts of other impacts on other areas of your life.
That's the other big piece is health, right? And we know that healthcare is expensive. And if people can afford to make healthier choices, they will do so. I think we've recently had another win in New York in that registered dietetic nutritionists are now covered under Medicaid as a service. So people can get nutrition therapy, which is great for that accountability and support as you're trying to make changes in your lifestyle and diet. But those changes can be hard if you don't have the financial resources in order to afford healthy food on a regular basis.
So, Natasha Pernicka, what are you doing on the ground right now? I know you're talking to me, obviously, getting the word out about the problem, and you've always been good about that. But what are you doing? What are the food pantries doing? How are we preparing? I know you said we can't possibly make up the difference, but I imagine you're trying.
Yeah, one of the things we're doing right now is we're building a New York State food supplier listing and map so that organizations across the state can find food supply chain partners. This is important because food banks are a critical, important part of the charitable food system, but the food supply chain is often inconsistent and unreliable. And pantries across the state have made a lot of strides to provide healthier food items and more culturally appropriate food items, things that people are used to eating, and it helps prevent food waste. And so we've heard over and over again that pantries and other community-based organizations are really needing a more resilient food supply chain. So that's one of the things we're doing. The other thing we're doing is just to help people and let them know, you know, if listeners are at a point where they're looking in their refrigerator and there's not a lot there, food pantries are there to help. And we do have a map of the entire state of New York with resources. It's the New York State Food Connect map at thefoodpantries.org, where you can find food pantries, community meal programs, SNAP and WIC access sites across the state. And we want people to know they're not alone. Don't be afraid to reach out for help. We'll do the best we can as a collective with the resources that we have right now to make sure that we can get people food.
On top of that, if you are experiencing hunger, you can also call the National Hunger Hotline. It's 1-866-HUNGRY. We've been speaking with Natasha Pernicka, the executive director of both the Alliance for a Hunger-Free New York and the Food Pantries for the Capital District. The issue is a stark one right now, and anything you can do if you have resources to help those that need food and are hungry, please take that opportunity. How can they reach out to your organization, Natasha?
Best way is thefoodpantries.org. Thefoodpantries.org is where the resource map is. Always happy to call our resource line, 518-458-1167.
Thank you so much, Natasha, for joining us on the Legislative Gazette today.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Nearly 97% of school district budgets passed this week. To understand the numbers and to learn about what factors impacted voters' decisions, the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard spoke with David Albert with the New York State School Boards Association.
One thing to remember when we talk about school budget votes is there's really two components of school budget votes. One is districts that just needed a simple majority vote in order to pass their budgets. And those are school districts that stayed within their tax cap. So state law requires districts to stay within their tax cap to get to just have a simple majority pass their vote. Or if they want to exceed their cap, they need to get a 60% supermajority of voters to approve their budget. So we always like to think about school budgets in those terms. We have the simple majorities, those within their tax cap, and then the supermajorities, those needing the 60% because they exceeded their cap. And if you average the two groups together, you get a 97% approval rate. That's the overall rate for all districts, identical to last year. But if you look at the override attempts, those were down this year. And there's not a lot of them. There were relatively speaking, there were 42 districts out of about 674 that held budget votes. There were 42 districts that exceeded their cap, their tax levy cap, so they needed that supermajority. So it's not a large number on the whole, but it is significant this year because it's the most number of tax cap overrides we've seen since 2012, the first year of the cap. And if you look at those votes, those were not as successful. Those passed at about a 60% passage rate. And that's actually down from last year, it was about 68%. So we did see a drop in the number of school districts that were able to override the tax cap.
Dave, what were some of the factors when you're hearing from school boards across the state? What were some of the financial pressures on districts this year that may clue you in as to why so many districts had a budget that required an override of the tax cap?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think districts always start from the perspective of they want to obviously provide the most educational programs and services as they can for students. So they're always looking to at least maintain the programs and services that they have, if that's possible. But when you talk about the fiscal pressures that districts face that might make that challenging, there are a number of them. So the first is that we see every year cost rise in school districts. If you think about a school district, you know, it's running, a transportation system that requires fuel. And so that, you know, that's expensive, the fuel for the buses, et cetera. You're also, you know, looking at health insurance costs every year. And this year, you know, property insurance costs went up. So districts were facing a lot of rising costs. And we began the year with inflation somewhere around 3%. So, again, there's those increased cost pressures that districts face. So that was one obstacle. Second obstacle this year was the late state budget. So school districts had to put their budgets out basically before they knew what their state aid numbers were. So even though the state budget was passed before the budget votes occurred on May 20th, districts complete their budgets weeks before the budget vote because they have to make sure that the public has adequate time to digest the budget, know what's in it, and they also have to report certain data points to the state. So this all has to be done long before the budget vote takes place. So districts had to really guess what their state aid numbers were going to be. And so as a result, we saw districts go right up against their tax cap, maybe, that was a factor because they didn't know what their state aid was going to be. Or we saw districts withdrawing or planning to withdraw from their rainy day funds because they weren't sure what their state aid numbers were going to be. So another financial pressure on school districts is state aid. So when we did get a state budget, it was a significant increase in foundation aid across the board in terms of the state. But there are a number of districts, hundreds of districts, and in fact, there's 400 school districts in this state that received a state increase of just 2%. And those many of those same districts received a 0% increase the prior year. So that leaves basically two options, or really three options for a school district, right? If they're not getting enough state aid to help cover the rising costs that they face, then they can either cut programs and services or take money from their rainy day fund or use tax levy, property tax levy. So districts really have to do a balancing act there. So I think there's a lot of different factors that we saw. And then the last factor I'll throw in there is the loss of federal funding, pandemic funding. So that funding actually expired in September 2024. So a lot of districts dealt with the loss of the pandemic funding. So this was funding that was done for programs like, after-school programs, academic enrichment, tutoring programs. There were programs at mental health services. So some districts were able to carry forward some of those positions in the current school year, but were not able to do so in this coming school year, September 2025-26, because they did not have the federal funding to support it because it had already been spent, and those programs are expiring. So those were some of the financial pressures that districts faced.
Now, with federal funding, the current administration is moving to what it says, eliminate the Department of Education. And the Department of Education does oversee funding for programs like special education and other programs that are more expensive for local districts to take on their own. Are school districts preparing for a loss in other kinds of federal aid beyond the pandemic relief dollars?
So at this point, we have not seen any indication that there would be any loss for school districts in either Title I or IDEA funding, which are two of the biggest federal funding programs. So Title I is federal funding that is concentrated largely for poorer schools, and IDEA is special education. That funding seems secure for 2025-26 school year, so we haven't really seen too much in terms of what districts being concerned about that funding. And were the education department to be abolished, that funding would likely just shift to another agency. So that is not a concern for the current school year. There is a potential that there could be, a risk to some Medicaid funding due to potential budget cuts. But other than that, you have to keep in mind that the local school districts here in New York are largely funded by state government and local taxpayers. The federal government provides about 6% overall of funding to schools. So it's not a significant amount. But that said, obviously, you don't want to lose, if you have a $100 million budget, you don't want to lose 6% of that. But we don't see a high risk in the coming school year for the loss of federal funds.
And just going back to districts that have not had their budget approved by voters this past Tuesday, in the Capital Region, Northville and Scotia Glenville are two districts. What is the course of action now for what a district can do if their budget didn't make it over the line, if there wasn't a supermajority to exceed the tax cap? What happens next?
So the school board really has three options if their budget's defeated. So option number one is they can put the same budget out for a revote in June. So revotes are held in June. and they can say, you know, it was a really close vote. We think that there's enough support for this, and they could try it again. Or they can make changes, and they can say, we're going to tweak the budget, we're going to make a few more cuts, and we're going to put the budget back out there, so it's a different budget. Or they can just say, we're going to go ahead and adopt a budget. And if they do that, then they have to have a zero tax levy increase. So that means they couldn't raise any more funds in property taxes than they did in this current school year. So, you know, that's obviously the trade-off for just going straight to a contingency budget. I think most districts will go ahead and put a budget out. Most of them will make changes to their budget. And typically we do see those budgets pass on the revote.
Dave, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
David Albert is Chief Communications and Marketing Officer at the New York State School Boards Association. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2521. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.